Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. You can count on one hand the number of days left before California's primary. But before us comes South Carolina. Could those results change things out west? Plus, if you love being outdoors, riding bikes, and drinking coffee, we found you a perfect little LA paradise.
Kind of cool to be so close to like congestion and traffic, but also feel like I'm sitting in the trees and my feet are in the dirt.
It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Ian Martinez. Happy Friday to everyone out there. Coming up, more than 700,000 K-12 students receive special education services in California. But a new report says the state has a long way to go to adequately meet their needs.
This issue is a crisis point. No matter how you look at the data, we're in dire need of improvement here in California.
That's all ahead on Take Two. But we start today with State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, polls show Bernie Sanders leading in California, but South Carolina may offer clues on which candidate can beat President Trump. We'll get into that and more with Jack Pitney. He's a Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also, I'm Marisa Lagos, the political correspondent for KQED. Welcome back, Marisa.
Hey.
All right. Let's start with you, Jack. A column in the LA Times this week makes a case that if Democratic voters here are not sold on Bernie Sanders, South Carolina's primary could offer up maybe a more moderate alternative ahead of Super Tuesday. So what do you say, Jack? Could South Carolina tell us something that we don't know right now?
The most important thing it could tell us would be if Joe Biden is a viable alternative to Bernie Sanders. It wouldn't necessarily ensure him the support of all the centrist or moderate voters, but it could indicate whether he has a chance of going on. That's important because a huge African-American electorate in South Carolina, that's Joe Biden's constituency. He absolutely has to win that and win it convincingly. But if he can do that, if he can win by double digits over Bernie Sanders, then he's the 77-year-old comeback kid. And
so the margin is important.
Yeah. Okay. Like gambling, it's a point spread. Yeah. If he edges Sanders by 2 or 3 points, that's not a victory. But if it's 10, 15, 20 points, then he does potentially have some momentum going into the Super Tuesday primaries, and that's awfully important.
Marisa, a new poll out today from the LA Times shows Sanders leading here by a 2-to-1 margin. Billionaire contenders Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg have spent a lot of money here, a lot of time here. Their narrow path to victory run through us here in California. But is it possible? Is it possible that their presence in the race could actually maybe sap some delegates from candidates with a better shot at beating Sanders for the nomination?
I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, for people who are not Bernie Sanders, the hope is that coming out of Super Tuesday that the field winnows to 2 or 3 candidates, right? Bernie and whoever else. You saw Elizabeth Warren making a really, I think, a strong play for that in the last two debates. But the problem for someone like Biden or Bloomberg is that, yeah, they are sort of running in the same lane. And, you know, given how much Bloomberg has spent, we're talking over $60 million in California alone on ads. I mean, to say that dwarfs anybody else spending on TV and digital is an overstatement by a huge magnitude. I think that this is really a sort of make or break moment for all of those more moderate centrist candidates. Whoever comes out in a strong position out of Super Tuesday is going to be the one that can really make the case against Sanders if that's the case. And I think, you know, there are open questions given the margins you pointed out here and some of the polling in other states if they're even going to be able to do that.
Marisa, say after Tuesday there is a top two in the Democratic Party that does not include Michael Bloomberg in that top two. Do you think he would stop spending? Do you think he would kind of just say, okay, thanks everyone for the time?
You know, I have a hard time believing Bloomberg will drop out that easily. I think that he's in it to win it, and he has the money. You know, what sort of from his perspective, there might be the argument, why drop out? But you know, he has repeatedly said he will support the nominee no matter who it is. I think at this point, he has taken so many people onto his payroll that the more interesting question is, like, how would he spend that money? What would he do? Would it be an actually, you know, try to funding sort of on the ground operations? Is it just sort of a PAC spending? I think there's a lot of open questions about what that looks like. And to your point, if he's really willing to do that, if it's Bernie Sanders.
Jack, what do you think? He's been a Republican. He's been a Democrat. Would Bloomberg go away for the Democratic Party if they asked him to?
I think it's possible. Depends on how he fares on Super Tuesday. It's possible that he could come out of Super Tuesday and not come ahead in any of the races, in which case he has to wonder, is he doing more harm than good? And that could damage him reputationally in the years ahead. As Marisa pointed out, he says he is going to keep his people on payroll through Election Day, no matter who the nominee is. And if he follows through on that, that could be a tremendous asset to the Democratic Party, particularly in the ground operation, making sure that people get to the polls and send in their ballots. If he does that, whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be in a much better place.
Now, Marisa, of course, Bernie Sanders does not have it in the bag yet. Last week, he actually warned that California's primary system could prevent millions of people from even participating in the primary. Why is that?
Yeah, so this is the kind of where the party primary system gets a little confusing. So, Republicans do not let non-Republicans vote in their primary. Democrats let independents and other parties vote, but they have to actually ask for that ballot. And so essentially Sanders is trying to get the message out because he's done very well among independents. They are, you know, over a quarter of the electorate here in California. No party preference voters are. And that is really a key constituency for him. I think it's worth noting whenever we talk about those voters that they are not monolithic and they are, you know, they do tend to skew one way or the other. But he's really hoping that those people understand the system, that they go either to their polling place and ask for that Democratic primary ballot or that they have asked for it already and got it through the mail. And I think that it is, you know, I think it's worth I think there's a danger when politicians try to make things sound like it might be a conspiracy, but I also think that there is a lot of confusion. We are getting a lot of questions in the roles that we sit in about this because people don't fully understand it. And I think his campaign is trying to do their best to make sure that the people who support him know how they can actually cast that ballot on Tuesday.
And Jack, with Bernie Sanders' poll numbers here in California, it adds a bit of concern for lawmakers who won seats in 2018 in purple districts. Take Harley Ruda, for example, in Orange County. He says he's worried that many voters might come out against Sanders in a general election. Is there concern for people like Harley Reid in this case?
Yes. Now, on the one hand, the Bernie Sanders people are saying with justification, look at the current polls. Bernie Sanders is actually beating Donald Trump in the trial heats. Bernie Sanders appears strong. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders has a lot of vulnerabilities, not the least of which he's a 70-year-old guy who's just had a heart attack. That would come up in a general election campaign and bring his numbers way down. That's why they're concerned about it. However, on the other hand, now I know I sound like Tevye, but if the economy tanks, and this week suggests that is a distinct possibility, any Democrat would be in a strong position in November, including Bernie Sanders.
I know Michael Bloomberg just recently put out a clean bill of health from his doctor and challenged Bernie Sanders to do the same. When did that become a thing? I don't remember. I know it's become a thing the last few elections, but I don't remember it being something 15, 20 years ago.
It's waxed and waned, of course. Okay. it's particularly prominent this time, given we have a 78-year-old guy who just had a heart attack.
Yeah. Marisa, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said that she'll embrace whoever becomes the nominee. Now, is it more politically advantageous for her to not put her thumb on the scale right now, to kind of hold back a little bit?
I mean, I think after 2016 and what happened with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, you're seeing this from virtually most sort of national party leaders and even our statewide leaders. I mean, think about it. Kamala Harris still hasn't endorsed someone. Gavin Newsom hasn't endorsed anyone. Jerry Brown hasn't endorsed anyone. I think it's no surprise that people in her position are not interested in wading into this fight until they know a little bit more about how voters are going. And I think that, yeah, politically, it would be a huge mistake at this moment for them to appear to put their thumb on the scale. And I think that that's, you know, similarly, we've heard nothing from President Obama. So, I think that this is sort of the messiness of this part of the primary is leading people in that position. I mean, of course, you go further down and there have been hundreds and hundreds of endorsements of, you know, congressmen and women and people like that. But I don't see the sort of political benefit at this moment, given what we just discussed on House races and everything else, for Pelosi to appear as if she is picking a horse at this late stage in the game.
Marisa, about 2 hours ago, I clicked on a misleading headline. It said Newsom endorses Elizabeth Warren. So I clicked on it right away, and it was Gavin Newsom's wife who endorsed Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I mean, she's obviously her own person and can do whatever she wants.
I thought it was the governor, sort of, though. That's what I was. That's why I clicked so quickly.
It's not the governor. No, it is for the first partner.
Yeah. Now, Marisa, the California GOP has really stepped up its game after losses in 2018. What have they done, and does it make them maybe more competitive this time around in California? Because we keep hearing how the GOP is fading away here.
Yeah. So, you know, they got a new head of the GOP last year, Jessica Milan Patterson, the first Latina to ever lead the party. She's young, she's energetic, and I think that she has really tried to sort of reverse some of what they saw as their failures in 2018. We're talking about things like early ground games, voter registration drives, but also that ballot harvesting we talked a lot about in 2018, which lets people, volunteers, essentially take absentee ballots and turn them in instead of, you know, on behalf of people. The Democrats use that new law to their advantage. The GOP says they don't like it, but they're going to play by the rules and try to do that themselves. So I do think it'll be interesting. You know, I mean, the numbers are not on their side. As I mentioned earlier, there are more no-party preference voters than registered Republicans. But, you know, every district is different. And I think that those sort of four congressional districts they're targeting, I mean, we're going to keep a close eye on because they were won by very thin margins. And, you know, Orange County is certainly turning blue, but it went bluer than a lot of people expected sooner than people expected.
All right. Let's talk about a word that a lot of Republicans have tried to stress when talking about Bernie Sanders, and that's the word socialism or socialist. It's thrown around a lot when it comes to Bernie Sanders. It plays a lot better with people under 30 than it does people over 50. That's according to a Pew survey last year. And Sanders has said that his brand of socialism is similar to Scandinavian socialism. Still, though, he went on 60 Minutes a few days ago and said this about former Cuban leader Fidel Castro.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it?
There's a lot of dissidents imprisoned in Cuba.
That's right. And we condemn that.
Jack, that comment did not go over very well in South Florida, or maybe all of Florida. But if he becomes the nominee for the Democratic Party, how do you expect this messaging to play in the general election?
Not very well. Fidel Castro just doesn't have a big fan club in the United States, except maybe for Berkeley and Santa Cruz. But, you know, I've never heard of a candidate losing because he didn't praise Castro enough. So this is all loss, no gain. If I were advising Bernie, I would say just stop praising Castro. Say you are against dictatorships, you think dictatorships are bad, and leave it at that. That's all you have to say on that subject.
Yeah, we've all known that he's taking these positions in the past. So just to do it now when he's kind of out there as much as he is, it does seem a little surprising, Marisa, that he would kind of double down on it?
Well, I mean, I think this is, on the other hand, this is one of the reasons that people really like Bernie Sanders, is that he has been consistent, right? I mean, when we're having fights about how somebody voted 25 years ago on the civil rights or on, you know, on a criminal justice act like Joe Biden, or if we're talking about Michael Bloomberg's record, I do think to Jack's point that there are ways to talk about this that are probably going to play better. On the other hand, we saw Bloomberg essentially praise President Xi in China and sort of, I mean, I think that there's a lot going on here that Bernie Sanders' opponents are making hay of. And I think that he's going to have to think about that messaging. But if you look at the numbers, you know, I think the idea that people who don't like Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party are trying to push that he is unelectable does not play out if you look at the polling numbers. And I think it's really going to depend on what the electorate looks like this fall. And as you said, younger people are very open to a lot of this. But it is sort of bizarre that we're sort of relitigating something that happened so long ago in so many ways, right? Fidel Castro is not around anymore. And it certainly doesn't seem like the most pressing issue for Americans when we do have a moment where there are authoritarian regimes that our own president has embraced in North Korea, Saudi Arabia. Like, it's interesting to me that there's so much time spent on this when there are actually current events that we could be talking about when it comes to authoritarian regimes.
Now, Marisa, pulling a distant fifth in California in that poll that I mentioned earlier is Joe Biden. His on-the-ground operations, you're really dwarfed by Sanders and Bloomberg. When it comes to Biden in California, is this a strategic move, a miscalculation, an oversight, or is maybe a financial decision? Because, you know, based on what happens in South Carolina, it seems like he needs a good win to stay in the race.
I mean, I think this is really a question of resources. I had Aith Smith, who helped run Kamala Harris's campaign, on my podcast last night. We were just talking about, you know, California is by its nature a place where most campaigns, unless you're Mike Bloomberg, have to triage. They have to make the call. Are we spending money on the ground? Are we spending money on TV? And I think that what we've seen with the Biden campaign, and quite frankly, several others, is they just did not have the resources to be playing in all the states at once that they needed to be. And so I think that, you know, as we've mentioned repeatedly, Biden is really staking sort of his hopes on South Carolina. I think he's hoping that momentum coming out of there will give him that bump, combined with, you know, his familiarity with voters. He has such a long history. He is a household name. Yeah. But, I would say besides Bernie and Bloomberg, it's been a hard sort of set of decisions to make in California for all of the campaigns in terms of resources.
I was just wondering, Jack, because California has this national reputation of shifting further to the left, that maybe Biden thought, well, okay, I'm not going to do well in California.
Yeah, and he almost certainly is not going to win. But the thing for Biden is, if he finishes a strong second, that's a win. Again, back to the point spread. Expectations in recent months were that he would fade very badly. But if he should get a nice bounce out of South Carolina, cross the 15% threshold statewide and in key districts, that could help keep him viable in the months ahead.
All right, you two. Last state of affairs before Californians head to the polls next week. I got to ask what you both will be watching for. So let's start with you, Marisa.
I mean, obviously, you know, who comes out, not just in first place, but how close anybody is. We also have a statewide bond measure on the ballot around school facilities. So I'll be watching to see what happens with that, and just sort of how this, what this might tell us about what the electorate might look like this November.
And that all the machines work, too. That's what...
Well, yeah, I mean, ideally, we're hoping things go smoother than Iowa.
Yeah. Jack, what about you? What are you going to be watching for?
Well, follow on that. How long is it going to take for us to know who the winner is in 2018 general election? It took a long time to get some of these congressional elections decided. The people who led on election night in several cases ended up losing very prominently. So we just don't know. On election night, we could have a very different outcome several days later.
Jack Pitney's a Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Marisa Lagos co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown on KQED. Jack, Marisa, happy Super Tuesday.
Happy Super Tuesday.
But if a kid's in special ed, you'd probably assume they're getting the kind of support they specifically need. Trained teachers, coordinated services between schools and other agencies, maybe help for college and career planning. Thing is, in California, that is not happening. Find out why when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. There are nearly a quarter million K-12 students in California who receive special education services. But a new report says the state has a long way to go to adequately serve those kids. Actually, 13 new reports, courtesy of PACE, Policy Analysis for California Education. With us to break down their findings is Heather Huff, the organization's executive director. Heather, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just to start off, where are some of the areas where California is falling short?
Well, this issue is a crisis point in California, actually, for a few reasons. Special education costs have been rising very quickly over the years, but revenues have not. We've had recent reforms to general education services, but not special education. So many districts across the state are feeling this pinch. We also, when you look at the way that California serves students, we have problems there as well. So for six consecutive years, California's been on the federal government's needs assessment list for poor compliance with federal law. And in California, parent complaints about the services their children receive is triple the national average. So no matter how you look at the data, we're in dire need of improvement here in California.
Wow. Okay. So as I mentioned, the report includes 13 different research publications looking at special education. What prompted you to do such a sweeping analysis, and how did you guys go about tackling this project?
Well, we had a lot of conversations with state policymakers and local leaders about what was the biggest priority for them, what was an area that needed additional research. And almost everybody we talked to all over the state said special education. We need to better understand how we fund special education, how we identify students for special education, how we make sure that teachers are able to teach students with disabilities, and how we can make sure that we prepare these students for college and career.
Kids with special needs have been around for a long time. So what was the reason why all of a sudden it seems like everyone needed to get up to speed?
Part of the situation is that the number of students identified with disabilities has increased pretty drastically in the past 10 years. 5% from 2005 to 2014, with the overall student population staying the same. So it kind of got worse and worse over time. And now we're at the point where it's reaching fever pitch because we've made changes to some of our other systems but haven't touched our systems for serving students with disabilities. So it's not that it just happened, but it's that over time it's gotten worse and harder, and now is feeling critical for many district leaders.
Now, when it comes to these students, tell us a little bit more about them that are enrolled in special ed. Are they mostly students with disabilities, or give us a snapshot?
Right. So in California, we have over 725,000 students that are receiving special education services. It's 11.7% of the student population. And like I said, the number identified in this group has increased 5.1% in the past 10 years or so. But the students who get these services are a really diverse group. Our students with low incidence disabilities, these are things like blindness or deafness that are severely disabling. But students can also be referred to special education because of learning or behavioral issues that are affecting their academic performance. And so what we find is that relative to their representation amongst all students, some student groups are more heavily represented. So we see that males, African American students, and English language learners and foster youth are more heavily represented amongst this group. Why it's important to understand this issue of identification is because in California, identification for special ed services is one of the only ways that students get additional support for learning.
Now, okay, so you mentioned that when it comes to identification, it's happening just more recently in the last few years. Does that mean that the state is doing a good job of IDing these students, or is that one of those areas that really needs improvement?
It's an area that needs improvement. So a big part of what's driving the increased caseloads and the increased identification in California is students on the autism spectrum, and that's in large part due to increasing awareness and identification over time. We do have a big problem, actually, with early identification in California. So we know that early identification is the best way to serve students and to reduce costs. Our research has shown, for example, that early programs providing health, learning support, and care from birth show a 13% return on investment per child per year. But we're doing really poorly in California making sure that students are identified early. We rank 43rd in developmental screening rates for young children.
Talking to Heather Huff, Executive Director of Policy Analysis for California Education, or PACE. Does that fall, Heather, on the teachers? Are teachers need to be better prepared to identify special ed kids?
In California and nationwide, the expectation for students with disabilities is that they're taught in what's called a least restrictive environment. The intention is that these students are in an inclusive setting. But we actually have the lowest inclusion rates in the country. And this has a few implications. One is that our general ed teachers, or just teachers with a standard teaching credential, they don't feel prepared to teach students with disabilities in an inclusion setting. And that is a problem in terms of how often teachers feel like they can include them. So these general ed teachers don't feel like they have the supports to serve students with additional levels of need, and they don't have those supports. But then we also have special education teachers. These are teachers that are specifically trained to serve students with special needs. And we have a lot of problems in that area as well. We don't have as many teachers who are going through training programs. And once they get into the classroom, they leave at much higher rates than in other states.
Does it stand to reason, Heather, that if special education teachers don't feel supported completely, that they just might want to just do something else with their lives?
That's right. I mean, teachers are like any other professional. They want to feel like they have what they need to be successful. And what we find here in California is that more than 1 in 5 teachers in special ed leave their position, which is more than in any other subject. So these teachers are overworked and undervalued, and our state policy systems really need to address that problem.
Now, back to the students. If these students don't get their needs met in school, what are some of the lasting impacts? How does it translate to life after secondary school?
Well, in California, about 70% of students with disabilities earned a diploma, so graduated high school, compared to 86% of all students. So that's a big difference. And we know that a high school diploma is really important for future work. What we see on that front is that half of students with disabilities are enrolled in higher education 1 year after high school. 25% of them are competitively employed, and just under 10% participate in employment or training programs after high school. And this, of course, has long-term lasting effects.
Heather, one last thing, and I realize this might be opening up a whole other can of worms, but briefly, is there enough money to make these changes happen in the next few years?
There is not enough money to make these changes happen in the next few years, and this is not something that's unique to serving students with disabilities. What the folks in our group talked about a lot is that special education students are general education students first, and we are underfunding vastly our schools in California. We need an additional $25.6 billion every year, which is 30% more than we've allocated, in order to really truly achieve the kinds of outcomes that we want to see for California. And until we can, as a state, make that a reality, we won't see the kinds of improvements that we want to see.
Heather Huff is Executive Director of Policy Analysis for California Education, or PACE. Heather, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All week, we've been hearing about the battle between the Orange County School of the Arts and Santa Ana Unified over the school's charter. There have been questions over enrollment and whether it's representative of the area it's in. Coming up, we'll hear where it all stands. Head on Take Two. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. For almost a year now, the Santa Ana Unified School District and the Orange County School of the Arts, also known as OSHA, have been battling it out over invoices, lawsuits, and the school's charter. So now the school is appealing to the County Board of Education. KPCC's Carla Javier reports on what could happen next.
The next County Board of Education meeting is on March 4th, and the five members might take up the future of OSHA. The school wants the county board to approve the appeal so they can continue offering academics during the day and arts in the afternoon, as they've done for 20 years. But founder and executive director Ralph Opasek says,
if we get denied at the Orange County Board of Education, we'll need to start notifying our families that it's likely that we'll be closing the doors in June.
To be clear, that is the worst case scenario, and it's not what Santa Ana Unified wants either.
That's not our intent.
That's Alfonso Jimenez, a deputy superintendent with the district. The district's lawyer, Sarah Sutherland, laid out their reasoning at the last County Board of Education meeting.
They meet criteria for approval and are a very high-performing school. The issue is that they are not reflective of the population, nor are all students being admitted.
Jimenez says all they want is for OSHA to be more accessible to kids in the neighborhood. So when OSHA's charter renewal came up late last year,
we approved it with conditions because we want the charter school to follow up on these concerns.
Last year, the district staff brought up disparities in race and income and raised questions about why local kids weren't applying to the public school. It worried that the school's model, which relies heavily on parent donations for funding, could discourage applications. The fight that's followed has parents and supporters nervous. 22,000 people have signed a petition in support of the school's appeal. Hundreds of supporters turned out at a recent Board of Education hearing to plead the school's case, including parents like Patty Wattis, whose daughter studies musical theater.
She's doing really well academically, and she's fully engaged, and I think she's finally found her tribe. OSHA is a gem.
And students like Louisa Romero, a classical and contemporary dancer from Santa Ana.
I believe that other artistic students should have the opportunity to experience this conservatory program and be able to grow and develop their passions like I was able to.
Marlene Peña-Marin's in charge of OSHA's Ballet Folklorico program. She sees it from both sides.
I understand where the district is coming from. I really do. And I am a product of the Santa Ana Unified School District.
She says she's seen OSHA become more inclusive over the years.
Has it been a slow process? Yes, I will definitely say that. But it's nice to see that the diversity is growing.
And she thinks that one of the changes the school has already made this year, replacing what used to be very competitive audition-based admissions with some kind of lottery, will make a difference.
We want this to be open for everybody.
Brad West knows firsthand how much hope OSHA holds. He had a tough home life.
You know, a low-income household.
But at OSHA, he was able to find his voice. Literally, he studied voice, even though his family couldn't pay the suggested donation. He wonders if there's a way to address the district's concerns without shutting everything down. Maybe
reach out to more local and low-income communities to say that, hey, look, you don't have to give $5,000 a year to go to the school or anything like that.
The folks who run OSHA have tried to expand their charter model in an effort to serve more students. They succeeded in Duarte. The California School of the Arts San Gabriel Valley opened in 2017. But similar attempts to open sister schools in Oceanside and Vista got turned down by those districts. Still, the school's founder, Opasek, feels hopeful about this Orange County board and this appeal.
Based on the meeting with staff, based on the types of questions that the board was asking, I'm feeling very confident that we're going to get approval.
Meanwhile, over 1,500 applicants are still vying for one of the coveted spots for next year. One of them is 13-year-old Aiden Roman from the city of Orange. He has a piano and he takes private lessons. He's been turned down twice so far, but he's learned from those rejections.
Try your hardest, even if it doesn't work out. Don't let anything get in your way. If you get discouraged, just keep going.
He doesn't know much about the fights. He just really likes OSHA and wants to go there. So he's focused on what he can control. A couple hours of practice, breathing exercises, even a prayer. He, like the school, hopes things work out in March.
That was KPCC's Carla Javier, and she's now in studio with us with more. Hey, Carla.
Hi there.
All right, we got some questions from readers and listeners, and you've looked into them and have some answers. So the first question comes from a listener who asks, what are the demographics of the students who are applying?
So that's something we talked a little bit about on the radio, and we have this interactive map on our website that shows all the applicants for spots in the current school year. We don't know their demographics in terms of race or income. That's not information that they're asked for when they apply. But we do know the demographics of enrolled students, because that's something that the California Department of Education does track.
All right, but you were able to deduce some things about the applicant pool.
Yeah, what we do know is where the students who apply are applying from. OSHA gave us that data. And we know that about 7% of them who are applying are coming from Santa Ana, where the school is located. Now, the Santa Ana Unified School District argues that the admissions process and big fundraising asks are barriers that are preventing local disadvantaged students from applying in the first place. But OSHA says the school's specialized programs are likely to draw from a narrower pool of students. Here's founder and executive director Ralph Opasek.
This is not like the traditional charter school down the street. These are students that are truly passionate about the arts. And so a student that's going to consider applying to and being part of the Orange County School of the Arts, it's a niche market.
For what it's worth, the overall acceptance rate at OSHA was 39%, though some conservatories are a bit more selective. Of the 7% of applicants from Santa Ana, a little more than a third of them got into the school.
All right. Up next, an anonymous listener wrote in with a comment, quote, perhaps a school such as this that reflects and draws students from the county as a whole should be overseen by the Orange County Department of Education rather than the local jurisdiction.
Looking at the numbers for this school year, 86% of the current students are from Orange County. A little more than 11% are from Los Angeles County. The rest come from Riverside, San Bernardino, San Diego counties, with a handful from further afield. Here's founder and executive director Ralph Opasek.
We've always been very clear since 2000, the 20 years we've been a charter, we're a regional program. We're drawing and attracting students from all over Orange County and greater Southern California.
And the school's demographics are closer to Orange County's than they are to Santa Ana Unified's, though there's still some differences there. When Santa Ana Unified raised questions about why the school wasn't attracting more local students, OSHA said it was living up to its original pledge to serve the entire county. And now it says that the county board would be a more appropriate body to consider their charter.
All right. Another anonymous person wrote in to say this, quote, did you discover on the parent funding agreement that the amount is a suggested donation that each family is asked to pledge an amount they can afford? We never were able to pledge the full amount and never received any backlash.
Yeah, well, OSHA says it's tuition free and that there's a fund to cover arts costs for those who cannot pay. The very last line of this year's parent funding agreement acknowledged that those asks are voluntary. But the school did hold mandatory meetings about these donations, and they say that it depends on donations. And if the school can't raise enough money, they'll start cutting some of the arts programming that drew students there in the first place. In future years, the school said it will call the form a voluntary contribution agreement to emphasize that it's not required. And in its report, Santa Ana Unified doesn't mention any backlash for enrolled students who don't give the full amount. But the staff did say, and this is a direct quote, parents who cannot afford to contribute are likely not to apply for admission, which is what we reported.
Before we get to the last question, Carla, I just find it interesting that there are a lot of anonymous parents that are asking questions. Are they worried that there will be backlash?
I don't really know why they're remaining anonymous. I do know in my reporting there were a lot of people who did want to ask questions anonymously because they worried about backlash from the supportive OSHA community.
All right. Now, one last question. What happens next for OSHA?
Well, that answer really depends on who you ask. Lawyers spent a good part of the last Orange County Board of Education meeting debating that question. The Orange County School of the Arts and its lawyers argue that when Santa Ana Unified's board voted in December to approve their charter with conditions, that in that approval, there was this thing that they're calling a poison pill. They're talking about a line. It says if OSHA, quote, fails to satisfy the conditions of renewal, the renewal petition shall be deemed denied. The school did reject the district's findings and decided not to revise their petition. So OSHA takes that to mean that it's been denied. That's why they think the county can hear an appeal. And they're hoping that the county does approve that appeal and will authorize their charter going forward starting in July.
But what is Santa Ana Unified saying?
It and its lawyers take the exact opposite position. They say that by voting to approve the charter with conditions, that that was an approval and that the school's charter for the next 5 years is already approved by them, and that Santa Ana Unified should continue to be the oversight agency for the school. No need for an appeal because they were never denied. We'll see what happens at the next county board meeting. That's on Wednesday, March 4th.
All right. That's KPECC reporter Carla Javier. You can read more of her reporting on our website. That's LAIST.com. LAIST.com. Carla, thanks for answering some of those questions.
Thanks for the opportunity, A.
Earlier this month, graduate students at UC Santa Cruz went on strike to protest low pay. They withheld grades and refused to hold office hours until their demands were met. Now students at other UC campuses are following suit. Yesterday, hundreds of grad students at UC Santa Barbara rallied on their campus, echoing the call for an increase in pay. Now among them is 23-year-old astrophysics student Megan Newsom.
It's all about living with some dignity and making sure we can do the jobs that we're being asked to do without burden.
Now, right now, grad students at UCSB are paid between $22,000 and $43,000 a year, which isn't a lot when you consider that Santa Barbara was ranked the sixth most expensive city in America. That's according to U.S. News and World Reports. In response to the strikes, the University of California filed unfair labor practice charges against the union representing UC student workers, a division of United Auto Workers, saying it did not take the steps necessary to stop the strikes. Meanwhile, the student worker union filed a suit against the University of California, alleging it engaged in unlawful bargaining by trying to deal directly with graduate students instead of meeting with them first. Grad student Megan Newsom says she hopes the protests will make the UC system think about how much it depends on grad students such as her.
I just hope a solid conversation comes about what it actually means to rely on graduate student labor for a university education system that is succeeding better and better every single year, but it's not sustainable in what it's giving back to the people providing that labor.
But for now, the strikes at both UC Santa Cruz and UC Santa Barbara continue with no sign of stopping. All right. right, imagine this for a second. You decided to just make a wholehearted commitment to bike to work. Just you and the cool, crisp morning air. You're pedaling on a bike path wedge right between the 5 and the LA River. And then mid-ride, you're thinking, a hot cup of coffee would really hit the spot right now. Well, you're in luck. There's a DIY cafe right there with a bunch of like-minded folks drinking some Joe, sitting next to their bikes, talking about life. It's a real thing, and we're going to take you there on take two when it continues in about 60 seconds. So stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right. It can be argued that L.A. is the pop-up capital of the world. Restaurants, art installations, you name it. But tucked between the 5 freeway and the L.A. River near Los Feliz and Atwater Village sits another type of pop-up, a cafe.
Everyone kind of just shows up and in one way or another ends up making coffee. Everyone kind of has their own little stove that they make, and we just, you know, have coffee and talk and catch up in the morning.
That's Aaron Rickle talking about LA River Camp Coffee, a DIY weekly pop-up cafe that's been coming together for about 6 years now. I headed over one Wednesday morning with Rickle, who wrote about the cafe for our sister site, LAist.
You can't really get here unless you're on a bike or walking. So pretty much, you know, people on their morning commutes or people just stopping in on... You get some unemployed people, you get some
you got people
self-employed people.
On their work commutes that stop here?
Yeah.
Really? So just like they would, I guess, at any other coffee shop to get a cup of coffee before they go into
totally.
Work.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Wow. It also seems like a very quiet place. Well, quiet in a way where you can kind of be reflective about your day or maybe even just think about life. I mean, what kind of conversations happen here?
I think there's a lot of chat, one, about coffee. Everyone's kind of an enthusiast and what, you know, talking about what different beans people are brewing or different, you know, techniques, anything like that. We'll talk about, you know, little spots in the city, some LA history. There's always something that I'm learning here.
Because this feels like we're in the middle of a perfect LA Venn diagram of wild LA and also urban LA. We've got the river right next to us. We've got the freeway also right next to us as well. It's where all kinds of different parts of LA intersect.
I mean, you could probably, like, hear the traffic in the background right from the 5. It's kind of cool to be so close to, like, congestion and traffic, but also feel like I'm sitting in the trees and my feet are in the dirt.
Now, everyone that comes here, does everyone bring a coffee setup to make their own coffee? What if I just wanted a cup? Could I come and just bring a cup, an empty cup?
You could beg. You could beg, borrow, and steal from somebody. I'm sure someone would be generous enough to brew you a cup. For the most part, everyone kind of brings their own stuff, though, whether that's walking in with a cup from Starbucks or whether that's making it yourself.
What do you think a place like this serves in terms of what it does for people? I mean, I can see someone in their commute stopping for a second just to rest, especially if they're cycling. Some people have a long commute, and this could be a great spot to kind of recharge, get a cup of coffee, and then go on to work. But for someone that just is hanging out, I mean, what does this do for them?
I think there's something about just taking an intentional second to sit outside in a morning that if I don't do this, there's no way I'm waking up at sunrise and sitting outside in my backyard or when I get to work. It's almost like a midweek restart for me.
How much do you need this?
I notice when I don't get it. I'll tell you that much. I think it really is kind of this nice restart throughout the week, and especially the last gig that I had was soul-sucking is maybe a little bit too harsh, but it was tough, and really like having that middle of the week time just to hang out with some people and have conversations that aren't work, and I think really got me through that job. And
see, this is the first time I met you, Aaron, but I see like a sparkle in your eye. So maybe that sparkle wasn't there before. Maybe it had been sucked out of your soul.
It's quite possible.
Yeah. How long can a place like this last? I mean, was one of those things where you want to keep it kind of on the down low a little bit so that a million people don't show up and ruin things? Because that's what happens, right? If something gets popular, it gets ruined.
Man, I don't know. That's tough. That's something I definitely go back and forth with, because on one hand, it's something that means a lot to me. Yeah. So I would want to share that with as many people as possible. I don't think anything gets ruined if a lot of people show up. There is, on the other hand, like something really special about feeling like there's this little like secret society of coffee people gathering in the morning. But I think the circumstances probably limit it more than anything else, that I don't know how many people are really willing to get up.
You got
to
commit, right?
I mean,
you
got to commit, yeah. Yeah, at the very least, you know, park across the river and walk across and wander into the park here.
Well, Aaron Rickel, thanks for telling us about this place through your article in LAS. We're going to talk to Aaron Vasquez, the guy who started this whole thing, in a second. But thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now we're with Aaron Vasquez, who started LA River Camp Coffee. Aaron, first off, what a cool little spot to be in. How did you pick this particular spot, Sunny Nook Park, to have this?
Just luck, really. I was just riding my bike by and saw this spot. I think they had been working on this for, seemed like forever, and it had opened recently at the time, so it just seemed like a nice central location for us to come and sit here. Nice little kind of amphitheater, easy bike parking everywhere. And just figured to give it a shot.
What made you think, okay, I want to do something like this? Because I know that it's a commute for you, right? Alhambra to Hollywood.
Yes.
Is this
yes.
A middle point of some sort?
Originally, it was a way just to get like a little kind of micro adventure in the way to work, you know, in the middle of the week, really. You know, everybody wants to be able to go out camping and hiking and doing everything they want to do all the time, but you can't really. So this was a way of like, well, let's just bring our camp stuff out and make coffee and or tea, or today looks like someone's going to be baking some cinnamon rolls or something
Danish
like that.
Cinnamon rolls, yeah.
So let's just try to use our camp stuff out here and just hang out for a bit before we go to work. Just break up the week a bit.
Now, did you start it just by yourself at first, or did you get a few people involved?
I found this spot and decided to try it here, and I came out here 1 week and just using the power of social media, I just posted a picture of myself sitting out here, and the next week I said, hey, I'm going to be at the same place at the same time, and three people showed up right away.
Wow.
And then the next week, from that core group of the four of us, just started growing and growing and growing every week. I think we grew up to like 50 people
nice.
A week. I mean, this place was like Standing Rocks only, I guess, at that point.
Talking to Aaron Vasquez, the creator of LA River Camp Coffee, right in Sunny Nook Park, right between the 5 and the LA River. Aaron, so for you, what does this do for you, for your soul, for your life, for just for your mental health?
I mean, it's really this community that's kind of popped up around here, and the people I've met through here is really the most amazing part of it. Sometimes I forget just how overwhelming it is that so many people like really kind of seem to appreciate it and still appreciate it and come back and just share a cup with us.
If you could sum up this place in a sentence or two, for someone that maybe is looking for a place in LA, because it's very tough here to find a place to just be reflective and think about things, and you want to bring them out here, what would you say to them?
I would just say this is a great place to come out and spend an hour before work and enjoy the city, enjoy the view, and hopefully enjoy some good conversation before you start your day.
That's Aaron Vasquez, the creator of LA River Camp Coffee. Aaron, thanks for having us out here.
Yeah, thanks for stopping by.
All right, finally, we have the weekend ahead of us, but if you're staring at a blank calendar, we can help you out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, summer is here, I guess.
Yes, it's warm.
Yeah, it's been really warm these past few days. It's supposed to cool down, though, just a little bit this weekend, but I wanted to share some things that are perfect for the outdoors.
All right, let's start off with something for people seeking culture.
Right, and this one's actually right off the Gold Line in Chinatown at LA State Historic Park. I've been seeing them set up for the past week, wondering what is going on, because they're doing a lot of set building for this. But tomorrow is opening night for the experimental opera. It's called Sweetland. It's run by the award-winning company The Industry, and here's the experimental part of the opera. It explores American identity between two groups called the Hosts and the Arrivals. You sort of get the theme here of immigration.
Yep.
But there are two parallel stories, or tracks, as you're taken along. When you arrive, you're actually sorted into one of the two, kind of like the sorting hat in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And I love this kind of theater because it encourages you to talk about your own experience with other people afterwards, how it was different, what you saw differently, and more. This promises to be incredible. incredible because the team behind it have won awards like the Pulitzer Prize and the MacArthur Genius Award. So yeah, it should be really up there. When you go, tickets start at $75, but that is not all, eh?
Get out. More?
Yeah. Oh. So apparently there's not just one great theater thing going on at LA State Historic Park, but two. Tomorrow is Bob Baker Day 2020.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's the famous marionette company that was once based in historic Filipino town, relocated to Highland Park. Tomorrow, they're on the road for an all-ages carnival featuring puppet shows, crafts, games, and more. Kitsch historian Charles Phoenix is the Grand Marshal.
Awesome.
And I did not know this. Actor David Arquette is a marionetter or whatever the name is. He's going to be doing a puppet show himself, too.
When you say there's more, take you seriously.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And this event is free.
All right. Now, so much going on in one place, but very exciting. But what if I'm just wiped out afterward and I want something low-key?
How about counting some sheep, literally? Okay. Because they actually need your help. It's a collaboration between state and federal officials and local conservation groups. They're going out this weekend to count bighorn sheep in the mountains as part of a census. See how they're doing, basically. It's in both LA and San Bernardino counties. You should be able to climb and scramble over boulders and endure at least 1 mile of hiking in rugged terrain. When you do this, it's free, but just make a reservation so you can know where exactly to go.
All right, one more event. Fluffy creatures involved?
Yeah, if you want more posh than rugged, go to Pomona tomorrow and Sunday for the, weirdly named for this area, the Beverly Hills Dog Show. To reaffirm, this is actually in Pomona, not Beverly Hills. But more than 2,000 dogs will be there to compete for best in show. Here's a pro tip. Go on Sunday because it's the puppy class that's competing. And when you go, that's free.
That's good.
Now, that is not all. The KPCC LAS gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check it out on LAST.com. That is LAIST.com. Also, if you want to find me on Twitter, I don't have a dog, but it's at Leo Has a Cat.
That's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks.
See you later, eh?
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our show was produced and directed by Austin Cross, Lori Skywalker-Galleretta, and Leo Duran. Ari Saperstein helped us out this week. Hazmik Pogosian is our engineer. Marina Pena is our news apprentice. Megan Larson is our editor and senior producer. Don't forget, Take Two's political coverage starts Monday at 2 for Super Tuesday on, of course, Tuesday. I'm Amy Martinez. Talk to you then at 2.